Welcome back to Closing the Gap, a podcast on gender bias in medicine. I'm Amber Sobrario, an emergency physician in San Antonio.
And I'm Laura Smiley, an emergency physician in Detroit. This podcast series is brought to you by our sponsors, Medical Center Emergency Services, a not-for-profit Democratic Emergency Medicine Group in Detroit, and Feminem.
The views expressed are those of the author and do not reflect the official views or policy of the Department of Defense or its components. Let's recap our last episode. We heard from Dr. Gloria Kuhn and Dr. Diane Birnbaumer on what it's like to break barriers as women in modern medicine.
And thanks to Gloria and Diane and thousands of others, women have made great progress in medicine. In this episode, we want to explore why the gender gap persists. One of the common themes for women 25 or 30 years ago was this experience of explicit gender bias.
What I did learn was when I was in medical school, this was a sincere question. One of the medical students that was in my class said, you know, we didn't think that women were smart enough to be doctors. And I knew he wasn't baiting me. He really thought about it. And I said, well, now you know.
There were some things that happened that in retrospect or now I would handle differently. Things like I had a head and neck surgeon I was working with on a rotation who was complimenting me, you know, 12 days from Sunday on my surgical skills, but then basically said, oh, but you're just a woman and you women are going to ruin medicine. I said, why? He said, well, you're going to make it a part-time career. Women never do anything as a full-time career. You're just going to make it part-time. You're going to undermine the value of medicine, which I was kind of shocked at. And the head of cardiothoracic surgery, when I did a presentation in front of the entire department that went quite well, had the chutzpah to stand up in front of everyone in the entire surgery department and compliment me on the presentation and then say, well, you must have been sleeping with the chief resident. It's so good.
As a society and workforce, we've improved over time. It's no longer okay to say things like that. And if you were to ask most people, I would bet that many, if not most, would say that women and men are equal. We know that in medicine and in most industries, women are not represented at the highest levels equally. So a lot of smart people started thinking and researching why that might be. It turns out that even though explicit gender bias has waned, implicit bias, or unconscious bias, has grown. This isn't as intuitive for folks to see. It's more difficult to recognize, and combating implicit bias can be extremely challenging. And as we are going to hear from our guest today, implicit bias can actually be more damaging to people than explicit bias.
So what is bias? Well, it's defined as a prejudice or unsupported judgment in favor of or against one thing, person, or group compared to another. It's in a way that's usually considered unfair. Implicit bias is unconscious. The person, by definition, doesn't realize that their thought process is based on an unsupported judgment.
Exactly. You and I are focusing mainly on implicit gender bias in this podcast. So what do we know about the root of gender bias?
Well, gender bias comes from our societal gender norms. Our American culture dictates that men should have more masculine or agentic traits, such as being authoritative, loud, logical, where women have more feminine or communal traits, such as being nurturing, soft, and emotional. Frequently, a man who's authoritative, loud, aggressive in the workplace is put on a leadership track, where a woman who expresses those same traits is often labeled as bossy or even bitchy. And the vice versa is true for men who are sympathetic, supportive, and caring. They're often labeled as weak or not fit to leave.
There was a study done with hiring bias that looked into applicants who took time off of work and how that affected their ability to get hired later. For men who took time off, it was assumed that they were into drugs, did jail time, or were a deadbeat. No one assumed parental care. For women who took time off of work, it was assumed that it was to have a baby.
And the analysis shows that men are expected to work without interruption, and if they do not, then the assumption of a negative stereotype is demonstrated, where women are expected to take time off for childbearing. So there's bias in both ways. Our expectations of gender norms lead to role expectations in and out of work. And when those expectations are not met, isolation of a specific person or group can occur. And this is bad for the team. It essentially disrupts a functional work culture.
Studies also show that a work culture that allows stereotyping to occur is not only detrimental to the individuals being negatively stereotyped, but also detrimental to their colleagues witnessing it. We know this contributes to why women don't attain the same status of men in the workplace. But now we also see that it contributes to an overall toxic environment, for everyone, women and men. The first step to fixing these issues is recognizing our own biases. We can then work on changing them. Research has shown individuals who report that they believe themselves to be unbiased aren't actually unbiased at all. They just fail to recognize their inherent biases. For example, we've all heard people who say, "I don't see color." This failure to acknowledge differences and the biases that go with those differences actually ends up contributing to more biased thoughts and actions.
So the most eye-opening way I found to help me assess my own bias and recognize it is using the Harvard Implicit Association Test, or the Harvard IAT Test, also known as Project Implicit. If you search Harvard IAT, you will find it, and we'll also have a link up on our show notes. And there's many associations you can choose from, but since we're on the topic of gender bias in the workplace, I would highly recommend Gender Career Test, as it's a great place to start. But I do also recommend you explore the other tests as well. Now, the results are not an end-all be-all, but it does give you some perspective of what your own knee-jerk reactions or unconscious biases may be, and gives you a place to start when combating them.
Now that we know what implicit bias is and where it comes from, we have with us an expert in the field, Dr. Molly Carnes, here to discuss how implicit gender bias affects both men and women in the workplace and how we can combat it as individuals and institutions. Dr. Carnes is the Jean Manchester Biddick Professor of Women's Health Research and the Director of the Center for Women's Health Research at the University of Wisconsin. She's also the Director of the VA Women's Health Program and the Co-Director of the Women in Science and Engineering Leadership Institute in the College of Engineering there. Dr. Carnes received her medical degree from the State University of New York at Buffalo and completed her residency, geriatric fellowship, and master's in epidemiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Carnes' research focuses on how cultural stereotypes influence judgments and decision-making in ways that constrain opportunities for careers in academic medicine, science, and engineering for women, and also for individuals from other groups that have not historically been well represented in these areas, particularly at the leadership level. Dr. Carnes, well, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
Tell us about yourself and how you became involved in research and medicine.
Well, I always liked science and math. I enjoyed them. And so when I was in college, I went to the University of Michigan, you know, big public university, lots of things to do. And I liked everything. I wasn't sure what I really wanted to do. I remember there was somebody on the floor in my dorm who was going to be a nurse. And I remember saying to my dad, "Well, you know, maybe I'll go into nursing." And he said, "Well, why not medicine? Why don't you be a doctor?" And I looking back, I think that just shows the importance of dads in affirming their daughter's, you know, skills. He's like, "Yeah, you're good at math. You're good at science. Why don't you be a doctor?" And so I went to pre-med and I got into med school, and that launched me on my career in medicine. I guess in terms of bias research, you want to know that too. So I always liked research, and I did residency in internal medicine at the University of Wisconsin. Again, a big research intensive public university, lots of smart people around, lots of science going on. I was attracted to academic medicine. Geriatrics was a new field, so that was kind of appealing because it was a combination of medicine and social science, economics, functional issues, and it was new. So I learned to write grants really early because even as a fellow, I helped develop geriatrics. And then I got on the tenure track. Once I got tenure at the University of Wisconsin as a faculty member, I looked around and I got tenure based on hormonal rhythms in rats. But once I got tenure, I looked around and I was the only woman with tenure in the entire Department of Medicine at that time. Now we have lots of women, but I thought, wow, this is a really intriguing question. You know, what sort of from an epidemiologic standpoint, what is killing the healthy women medical students so they're not surviving to tenured faculty, because no disease, you know, in the Western Hemisphere has that kind of mortality rate. And so I closed my lab and switched my area of research to studying that very compelling issue. So that was kind of my first foray into bias research.
That's so funny that you kind of made that medical analogy of there must be a disease state for women and what is affecting us and what literally what's killing us off, what's killing our careers. So how was it for you? as a woman in medicine when you were training, and then when you were a fellow, and when you were junior faculty, how did you find that as you got to every level and then you found yourself, the cheese stands alone? How did that feel?
Well, it's interesting because the human mind is so unique in that you can look back at something that happened earlier in your life through the subsequent experiences you've had. Because remember, when I went to medical school, it was only 2 years after Title IX was passed. So Title IX, of course, the Education Amendment of the Civil Rights Act, which made it illegal to discriminate in terms of admitting women to any educational institution that accepted federal dollars, which was essentially all of them. So, before 1972, there were overt quotas for women in medical schools, right? We can allow only 10% of our class to be women. I mean, that was allowed. And so that was set 1972, Title IX of Education Amendment of the Civil Rights Act was passed, the Patsy Mink Amendment, named after Patsy Mink, who wasn't allowed to go to medical school. So she became a lawyer and drafted Title IX. Yeah, so 1974, I got into medical school. So at that time, gender bias wasn't implicit. It was overt. I had professors who looked me right in the eye and said, I don't think women have what it takes to be doctors. I don't think, you're just taking the spot of a man. You're just going to drop out and get pregnant. I reached out to the head of research, letting him know that I really thought I wanted a research career. I loved research. And he told me point blank, he said, women don't have what it takes to be researchers. So it was a different time. Nobody would, I hope, ever say that now. So later on, when I came to study these issues, I recognized, and of course, this has been shown experimentally, that kind of actual overt gender bias in some ways is less damaging because it can trigger what's called reactance. So, you hear that explicit bias and you're like, well, that's not true. I'm going to show them, I'm just going to work twice as hard and succeed. So I always thought it was a problem with everybody else. Because I had this inoculation of confidence from my parents that basically whatever I set my mind to, I could do. So I didn't view it as I didn't view it as implicit bias. It was only later when I came to realize that even when people are dedicated to being fair in their judgments and decision making, and they value egalitarian ideals, and they think women should be in medicine, that even when that is the case, as it wasn't right after Title IX, but even when that's the case, it's these more implicit kinds of cognitive distortions that emanate from the mere existence of stereotypes about groups of people, and how I became fascinated and how the mere existence of stereotypes can lead to some stereotyped advantaged and some stereotyped disadvantaged groups. And in academic science and medicine, it filters out women, and it filters out people from ethnic and racial underrepresented minority groups, both men and women, or people with disabilities, or people who are not in the group that has been historically represented among top leadership in the field.
So you've had this wonderful long career. And like you said, the bias was very explicit at the beginning. At what point did you start to feel that change?
If we stay in a gender context, so for women, when Title IX was passed, I think it was, in retrospect, of course, naive, but it wasn't unrealistic at that time to think that now that the doors were open to women in all fields of science, medicine, engineering, if we just waited long enough, we would see equilibration. The doors are open now. Previously, they were closed to women, so of course there weren't enough women, but if we just wait, we're going to see equilibration. But now it's, 45 years after Title IX, we have not seen that. So I think, that stimulates inquiring minds to say, okay, well, what else could be happening? In 1972, say, you'd never seen a woman surgeon, certainly not a woman orthopedic surgeon. You'd never seen a woman chair of medicine. So maybe you could say, well, gee, maybe women can't really do it. They haven't been. But now, of course, there's lots and lots of examples of very effective women in all kinds of positions. And there's research showing, if we focus on physicians, for example, there's 4 studies now showing that there's not only no difference in clinical outcomes between male and female physicians in patient outcomes. In some realms, outcomes for women may actually be better, at least a mean. You know, I hate to generalize, but certainly nothing to suggest there's anything about gender that would make women less able to be very effective in any role in academic science and medicine. And yet we still see, for example, only 9% of interventional cardiologists are women. And that's in training. I think it's only 4% of practicing. And we see, you know, 80% of pediatricians and 70% of veterinary medicine and pharmacists. You know, why are we seeing this shocking occupational sex segregation if the doors of all fields are open to men and women?
So that leads very nicely into your area of expertise, which is implicit bias. Can you tell us more about that and why everyone needs to believe the research and maybe be aware of the research? I'm hoping that we're doing a better job of sharing that, that we think that implicit bias, and I think you've shown that implicit bias has a large role in that.
So yes, and my work builds on the shoulders of great experimental social psychologists. I had the wonderful opportunity to collaborate on a study with Trish Devine, who's at the University of Wisconsin. And we have one of the top psychology departments in the country. And it was actually her work as a graduate student back in the late 80s that first demonstrated that humans have these two types of intergroup bias, right? They have these explicit, consciously endorsed beliefs, and they have these more unintentional, automatic cognitive processes that occur simply because stereotypes about groups of people exist and we know them. So I became fascinated with how those kinds of processes conspire to constrain opportunities for women in academic science and medicine, and then broaden my research to other fields and women of all colors.
One of your pieces of work that we've used a lot, at least me and Laura have, to help others learn about implicit bias, because I think still a lot of people out there don't understand what it is or what it means, is this breaking the habit or breaking the bias habit. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and how you came to develop that?
So again, that was my first collaboration with Patricia Devine, which worked out really well because I was kind of moving in that direction. I was increasingly seeing gender bias and how we could break it. I was making the analogy to smoking cessation, saying that, you know, what we need is a change in the cultural norms of academic institutions. If you remember, you know, there's been certainly a cultural change around smoking. I mean, in the 1970s, you know, there was smoking in restaurants and airplanes and bars. My medical school professors would smoke in the classroom, and nurses would smoke in little rooms off the intensive care unit. If you told somebody in the 70s there would be no smoking in bars in the late 1990s or 2000s, they would have laughed at you. So, but when you think what it took to make that cultural change, it's sort of the same that I was envisioning around cultural change for at that time, gender bias, right? So you had to have enough people recognize that it was there and change their own bias habits and then advocate for policy change. And so at the end of the day, I always had this vision that, you know, if you saw a room full of leaders in any institution and they were all white men, you would have the same kind of visceral reaction that it was bad for the institution, it was bad for the individuals, that you would have if they were smoking cigarettes. And so that was the way I was sort of framing it. And then it turned out Trish Devine's work was also very much in that direction. She was increasingly looking at these implicit cognitive processes that derive from cultural stereotypes as habits that could be broken. And so we were fortunate that NIH had put out a call for an R01, the grant mechanism that NIH supports for independent, you know, for supporting research. And we got funding to develop this Breaking the Bias Habit workshop, in which we incorporated strategies to basically from smoking cessation, from health behavioral change, you know, recognizing that changing any habit, whether it's bias or stopping smoking, is a multi-step process. So we knew, just like you have to make people aware that smoking's a problem and arm them with tools to help them be confident they can change a habit, that we had to do the same thing with bias. You know, we had to show people that bias existed. We had to give them tools to practice, to break their own bias habit. And then, as you said, in that study, which was really quite an ambitious study, in the middle of it, we thought, oh my God, is this going to work? But we had 92 departmental type units at the University of Wisconsin. We randomly allocated 46 to get this bias habit reducing workshop and 46 to be controls. And we had online measures that assessed self-reported proximal measures of behavioral change and whether people were acting on a regular basis to engage in bias habit reducing activities. And we took these little online measures at baseline before any department got the workshop, and then 3 days and 3 months after the workshop was given. And we found that faculty in the departments that got the workshop were indeed significantly more likely to be aware of their own personal bias, to say that they were confident that they could engage in bias-reducing activities and that they were doing so on a regular basis. And then we further found that the departments that got the workshop, both male and female faculty were experiencing a more positive climate. They felt they fit in their department. They felt respected by their colleagues. They felt comfortable raising personal or family issues, even when it conflicted with departmental activities. So this was amazing. That was what we reported in our academic medicine paper. But, you know, those are self-reported measures. You could be critical of them. So we then went back 3 years later and looked at hard institutional outcomes and found that the departments that got the workshop had significantly higher retention rates for male faculty. And among new hires, it was essentially gender parity. It was essentially half men and half women among new hires, whereas the control departments remained at 32%.
So that is outstanding and amazing. And I think that is going to be the thing that people can take to their departments or their institutions and say, look at what happens, and this is why it's good for you. It's not just good for you because we think it's the right thing to do. And it's not good to do just because your people are more satisfied. Not only are they more satisfied, but they stay and they do more work for you. You know, I mean, like, I think this is how we're going to be able to kind of sell this as an issue to people who don't believe. And that's something that we're working on here in Detroit for sure.
University of Pennsylvania, Stephanie Abul and her colleagues, Alyssa Westering and others, did also a cluster randomized study of within, I believe, the Department of Medicine. It might have been in the whole medical school. I can't remember. But back, they have this wonderful study that found they called it culture. We refer to it as climate. The climate of a department is really, really important in terms of the perception of work-life balance. So if you wanted a compelling argument to convince chairs to invest in improving the climate for women, they found if women faculty felt that they were in a department with a supportive climate, they would work up to, I believe it was 70 hours a week, and still feel they had good work-life balance. But the women who were in departments where they did not feel they had a supportive climate, they felt they had poor work-life balance even when they were working 40 hours a week. So you could get, you know, an additional 30 hours a week out of your women faculty if you just had the perception of a supportive climate in your department.
Oh my gosh, let alone the retention, and then the men benefit too because the women are happy.
Yeah, well, everybody's happy.
Right, everybody's happy.
Well, you know, of course, there are limitations. That my particular study focused on gender bias, and it was only at one institution. So the current study we're doing, the bias reduction in internal medicine study, so the BRIM study, also funded in large part by an NIH grant, aims to see whether this approach, this breaking the bias habit approach or motivated self-regulation, if you will, whether this works beyond just the University of Wisconsin and beyond a gender focus. So We've selected departments of medicine to focus on because they're large, so they often tend to be institutional leaders within the medical school, and they're broken into these wonderful divisions. So the subspecialties of medicine, you know, cardiology, pulmonary, infectious disease, et cetera, which allows us to do a cluster randomized design. So we have 20 departments of medicine around the country participating in this. And here, the workshop, we've updated it. Obviously, there's been a lot of new research in the area. And so the structure of the workshop is basically the same. The bias habit reducing strategies that we promote are somewhat the same, but we focus on more clinical examples, and it goes beyond gender. So, you know, it addresses these kinds of biases against multiple groups. So race, gender, LGBT, obesity, disability, to show how these cognitive processes can lead to the same kinds of biases against almost any group.
I'm really looking forward to that, the results coming out from that as well. And we have a whole episode. It might not, but I'm still looking forward to it. But we have a whole episode kind of dedicated to how, you know, the stuff we're talking about on this podcast can apply more than just gender. It can apply to race and, like you said, other underrepresented minorities. So I'm excited to see what happens with that study.
Well, you know, we focus on how these kinds of, I'll go back to a gender contrast, we focus on how these gender stereotypes work against women in academic science and medicine, because we're talking about fields that have historically been occupied by men, and for which there's more of an alignment with our stereotypes about men and what we think are needed to succeed in these roles. But we have to remember that these stereotypes also disadvantage men. And I think it's really important to emphasize that. You know, for example, there's a number of researchers, including Lori Rudman from Rutgers, who has studied the negative impact on men who request flexible leave, because that's seen as violating, you know, the gender stereotype that men are going to be the breadwinner and, you know, linearly employed. And so if they request family leave, and again, her work has looked at this experimentally. So in some of her studies, she has a male employee who either does or doesn't ask for family leave to, you know, care for a mother with Alzheimer's disease or a child with leukemia. Very compelling reason. But then the participants in the study just negatively evaluate the man who asks for the family leave. You know, he's viewed as less competent, less committed. And if there's a downsizing of the company, he should be gotten rid of. And they also ask participants, like, sort of how stereotypically masculine do you see these employees? And the man who asks for family leave is viewed as not as stereotypically masculine. And it's those results in their mediation analyses that completely explains the negative evaluation in the employment realm.
Yeah, I agree. And I think addressing this as how this can better the entire workplace is what we're trying to get at, instituting these ideas of bias and how it affects everyone in the workplace, either male or female or based on gender or not, I think is important. It helps our bottom line. It helps everyone. Earlier, you mentioned how explicit gender bias isn't as detrimental as implicit gender bias. Do you care to elaborate that on a little bit further? Because some of our audience doesn't understand what it means to have the detrimental effects of implicit bias. And it's usually described as kind of death by a thousand paper cuts, and how that can be worse for the people experiencing that in a negative way.
Well, certainly I'm not advocating for explicit bias, and it can certainly be very damaging too, particularly if it translates into, you know, very explicit decisions in hiring or promotion. But to an individual person, sometimes those explicit statements can be less damaging because you know exactly where they're coming from. You know where that person is. There's no ambiguity. And sometimes it's the ambiguity, you know, like when somebody will say something, or, you know, they'll laugh at a sexist joke, or and you're just sort of not sure where you fit in that gendered assumption. And it can trigger feelings of inadequacy. It can trigger things like stereotype threat. So, you know, there's this phenomenon of stereotype threat, which was first described by Claude Steele at Stanford, I think 20 years ago now. And it's the phenomenon whereby if you are a member of a group that has negative performance stereotypes as part of the stereotype, right? So women in math or African-Americans in academic success, and somehow, and you care about your performance, you have to care about your performance. If something reminds you that you're a member of that group, say during a test or during an activity, it can actually make you underperform relative to your abilities through this phenomenon that he labels stereotype threat. So sort of, you know, the threat of confirming the stereotype. And again, these are implicitly activated. The person is not aware that it's happening. In fact, Claude Steele has shown in his work with African-Americans and academic performance that if you let people know explicitly that this can happen, it actually does a lot to prevent stereotype threat from occurring. So that's another example of where sort of making the implicit explicit can actually be a positive intervention. But in terms of stereotype threat in women in academic medicine, if you think of leadership, so again, coming from Steele's lab, they've shown because negative leadership performance is part of the stereotype about women. So if you activate female gender stereotypes, women are significantly less likely to choose a leadership role in a subsequent experiment. They're more likely to choose a supporter role. And when you think about what activates stereotype threat, our environment in medicine is full of things that activate it. You know, women are often a token minority. That alone can activate it. The traits that we think align with a successful, you know, physician leader or orthopedic surgeon or maybe an ER doc, you know, what we think makes an excellent one of those align much more strongly with a male gendered stereotype. And then, of course, women in medicine are surrounded by people where the roles for women are much more likely to be in supportive subordinate positions, and the roles for men are much more likely to be in the leader, especially top leader position. That alone could trigger stereotype threat.
So as you're going around doing these workshops, now that you've kind of taken it on the road, so to speak, what are some of the things? Are you hearing some common stories from people? Can you share some of those with us?
Well, in terms of people buying into participating in the workshop so far, I have to say we have just been blown away with the interest and the willingness to attend a 3-hour workshop, which is not easy in busy clinical departments. You know, and we've had, you know, senior faculty who've come to these workshops saying, well, you know, I came because, you know, my chair said it was a good thing to do and it's NIH funded. And they've said, you know, this was wonderful. This really, you know, changes the way I think about things. This is really needed. Thank you. And they say the 3 hours went by quickly. Now, not all of them are giving those rosy of an evaluation, but I would say overall, we've been really impressed with the buy-in to the initiative. In terms of stories we've heard from the faculty participants, I mean, it mostly reinforces what you already know. You know, women faculty often talk about, you know, their voices being ignored in meetings. And, you know, we give them strategies for that. They talk about some of the interpersonal microaggressions, talk about being mistaken for nurses frequently, again, because of that status leveling. So we hear just stories that would be familiar to you, but that reinforce that, you know, we're doing something hopefully that's going to be moving 20 institutions in a positive direction.
So I know that we've talked about on this podcast, and you've talked about kind of strategies for individuals and then strategies for institutions. But is there, I'm curious, when we kind of went through this at our home institution, some of the men were very supportive of the idea of, you know, trying to improve the climate or the culture, but they didn't know how. and they didn't know what that would look like. Do you have any like kind of modeling behaviors or any like suggestions for the men and how they can help?
Well, men and women, we have to remember this isn't about men doing this to women. So all of the studies pretty much show that because we live in this society, men and women harbor the exact same implicit biases. So both men and women in all these experimental studies will rate the quality of the work of women lower than the quality of the work of men, and the same kinds of biases. So this is not about just giving something to men. So, you know, some of the strategies are just very simple. The first one is just becoming much more intentional about recognizing when you see stereotypes portrayed about women or any group, recognizing that they're stereotypes, and then, you know, calling them out, you know, challenging the stereotype with real data. For example, in a clinical setting, it's been shown repeatedly that there are stereotypes that Black patients are going to be less compliant or less adherent to the recommendations of the physicians than white patients. That is a bias physicians hold. That's been shown. So when I talk to the residents in Wisconsin, I say, well, physicians hold that bias, but I can 100% guarantee you that you are seeing more white patients who will not adhere to your recommended treatment plan than Black patients because of base rate fallacy, right? Because in Wisconsin, they are seeing far more white patients than Black patients. So, you know, just challenging some of these assumptions with real data.
Your point is well taken that, you know, in the studies for evaluations of residents and other things, women are just as hard, or if not harder, on women than men are. So I think it's a point well taken that everyone can improve how they identify and then react to these kind of biases that we have.
So I'll give you, you know, just one more strategy. So certainly intentionally recognizing stereotypes and replacing them with data. And then again, out of experimental social psychology, it's called perceiving variability. And it's just practicing making sure that you consciously recognize that every single group has multiple subgroups. So if you hear somebody say, for example, well, we'll go back to the one I just mentioned. If they say Black patients are less adherent with the treatment plan, okay, that is a stereotype. So you can interrupt that and say, well, you know, some Black patients may be not adherent. Some Black patients are very adherent. Some Black patients are overall more adherent than your white patients. You know, so just recognizing that there's many subgroups. Or if you hear somebody say, you know, women don't want to do that, okay, you got to interrupt that right away. So you say, well, some women don't want to do that. Some women might want to do that. Say it's leadership. Say, oh, women with children don't want to be leaders. Well, some women with children may not want to be leaders. Some women with children may really relish the opportunity for leadership, and some don't care. But whatever it is, when you hear that, you got to interrupt that right away and encourage perceiving variability.
This recognition of your bias, all this kind of personal individual work that I'm doing and that we are all trying to do. I'm learning so much, and I'm finding it to be, it's very exhausting to always be so cognizant of what you're doing. I think over time I'm finding it easier. Is that something that you've seen kind of play out, that it becomes this habit? You know, you broke a habit and you replace it with another habit?
Sure. That's why we're finding it so successful to mobilize strategies that help people break any habit. It is not easy to change a well-entrenched habit. If it were, we wouldn't have 40 million smokers in the U.S. I mean, the good news is we now have the lowest rate of smoking we've had in generations, right? Less than 15% of the U.S. population is smoking, but we still have 40 million smokers, right? It's not easy to break a habit. And if you think about when you wanted to change any behavioral habit at first, or even learning, you know, when you want to learn to be a physician, right? You are paying a lot of attention to, you know, how you listen to those heart tones, how you examine the lungs, how you feel for that liver. And you practice it. You practice it. It's very intentional. And then, you know, it becomes such a habit. You can converse with the patient while you're feeling for the liver, or you can talk to the medical students while you're examining the reflexes. You know, it becomes so habitual. It's an implicit process. And our goal is to, again, make these kinds of implicit cognitive processes that disadvantage people, to break that habit so people are interrupting the stereotype-based implicit bias and behaving in a way that is egalitarian and fair.
I talk a lot with the residents about, you know, going through the stages of learning, kind of like what you were talking about. You know, you go from unconsciously incompetent to consciously incompetent and then consciously competent. You know, you still are working at it, but you're getting there. And then, you know, hopefully 10 years out, you should be unconsciously competent. And so I think that you can apply that to this implicit bias as well.
Absolutely.
I was actually just thinking that as you were saying it right before you said it. So,
well, then you must have learned something from me.
Yeah, you must have.
No, actually, in our original conceptual model, we use those terms as well. So that we use the terms of health behavioral change, but also those, I believe it's from Howell, those terms from learning.
In one of our other episodes, we talk about financial transparency as another way to open things up for women in medicine, financial transparency, salary transparency for academic people. And I think that is another intervention that kind of goes hand in hand with this habit modification program that you're having. Is that anything that you've looked at ever before about kind of salary transparency?
Yes, I think, well, transparency in anything is good. So even if you don't agree with the way salary is justified, if you see what went into the formula to determine a salary, employees are generally more satisfied. So I think transparency across the board is good. Salary is often a marker for status, how much we value things. So it is not surprising that no matter what study you look at, women are paid less. The conflation of gender and status, so that in our society, women and things associated with female are viewed of lower status than men and things associated with male. And if that weren't the case, none of this would be happening, right? Because then things we associate with female would be viewed with as great a status as things associated with male, and salaries would be equal, and there wouldn't be this constant sort of social drive for men to be in the higher status positions and women to be in the lower status. Because, you know, even if you look at salary as a marker of status, so our highest status fields then would be things like orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery, interventional cardiology, the highest salaries within medicine, very few women. And if you look at things like, you know, pediatrics, family medicine, over 50% women, low salaries relative to medicine. And then even within those fields, so say within family medicine, pediatrics, the men that are in those fields tend to sort of socially be steered toward the higher status positions, right? They're more likely to be chairs. They're more likely to be in the subspecialties and more likely to be doing research and on tenure track. And within the, you know, the orthopedic surgery, interventional cardiology fields, the women are more likely to be in the lower status positions, right? They're more likely to be doing teaching, less likely to be doing research. I'm told even within orthopedics, the men are more likely to operate on the, you know, big joints of the knees and hips, and the women are more likely to be operating on the delicate joints of the, you know, hands and feet. So we're not aware that it's happening, but this implicit socialization of men toward higher status things and women toward lower status things, until we recognize that and deal with it, you are always going to be seeing the salary gap.
You know, we have studies that prove that that's still happening, that there is a salary gap, especially in medicine. But I think it's nice to hear what an expert thinks of what's behind that.
Well, ladies, this has been an excellent discussion, but unfortunately, we do have to wrap things up. But before we go, Dr. Carnes, do you have any advice for women and even men out there that are experiencing gender bias every day?
It is helpful for women to understand the research. Even if when they first begin to digest some of this research, it might make them angry because they say, well, it shouldn't be that way. But I think if you understand how these well-entrenched gender stereotypes can unintentionally play out both in your own behavior and choices and in the way other people evaluate your behavior and your work, I think it can help prevent it from feeling so personal or feeling that there's something wrong with you. You know, you sort of recognize, say, oh yeah, that's how that plays out. It has nothing to do with me. It's not really my talent. It's just that it's viewed differently in this situation. So I do think it's important for women and men to at least have some understanding of the research behind these implicit cognitive processes.
I think with your work that you are, you know, your papers are so well done, and then your research is continuing, and then hopefully with smaller interventions like podcasts like this, that hopefully we'll get more of that out so that people do understand, especially the junior people who don't have the experience to say, oh, this is this really how it is, or is this just me? Right. So I think hopefully I definitely had that feeling when I was a resident, and now I'm still very junior faculty. So I'm still coming up against that often, and reading these papers is very, very helpful to me personally.
I think this was excellent.
Thank you for doing this. I think this is such a wonderful initiative.
So what we learned today is that we all have biases, but the good news is that there are some tools out there like the Harvard IAT test to help us identify our biases, and some simple strategies out there like breaking the habit that can help us combat them. Many thanks to Dr. Kearns for her important work and ongoing contributions to finding solutions. Much more to come from her and her colleagues. Laura, what's the plan for our next episode?
So far on Closing the Gap, we've focused on how gender bias affects us as physicians. But how does it affect our patients? In our next episode, we'll discuss how gender bias can adversely affect patient care and how gender equity actually improves care. We'll hear from Dr. Teresa Smith, who will share her story about her experiences both as a physician and as a patient.
So make sure you join us next time on Closing the Gap.